Do you ever catch yourself saying, English is just crazy? Maybe your students come across a tricky word and you tell them, you just have to memorize that one, or this is the part you have to know by heart. But deep down, you know it's still confusing. Here's the truth. English isn't random. It's a wonderfully complex system, and once you understand how that system works, through sound, structure, and meaning, everything changes. That's what Sarah Paul and I teach inside Mastering Morphology. This isn't another curriculum. It's deep teacher knowledge inside a practical comprehensive course that finally shows you how words really work. No more exceptions, no more gimmicks or patching holes with memorization or phonics alone. It's time to go beyond sound it out and give your students the framework they need to truly understand words. So if you're ready to stop guessing and start teaching with confidence, join us inside Mastering Morphology. Enrollment is open now, so we invite you to click the link in the show notes to get started. You're listening to episode 52 of Literacy in Color. On today's episode of Literacy in Color, I'm joined by someone whose work has transformed the way we think about reading instruction and intervention, Dr. David Kilpatrick. Dr. Kilpatrick is a professor emeritus of psychology for the State University of New York at Cortland. He's a New York State certified school psychologist with 28 years of experience in schools. He's been teaching courses in learning disabilities and educational psychology since 1994. Dr. Kilpatrick is also a reading researcher and the author of two books on reading, Essentials of Assessing, Preventing, and Overcoming Reading Difficulties, and Equipped for Reading Success. He's also co-editor of a third, Reading Development and Difficulties, Bridging the Gap Between Research and Practice. In this conversation, we dig into what the research actually says about phonemic awareness, a topic that has sparked a lot of debate in recent years. Should we do phonemic awareness with or without letters? Are certain phonemic awareness tasks better than others? Dr. Kilpatrick explains what the research actually says about oral-only phonemic awareness and the National Reading Panel findings. We also discuss why phonics alone is not enough when we consider our most vulnerable readers. You'll hear how phonemic proficiency, or instant automatic access to phonemes, is critical for remembering words, and why avoiding oral-only phonemic awareness for students on the lower end of the continuum can leave them behind. I've linked a hefty bank of research references in the show notes so you can explore these findings yourself. This is a conversation that dispels misunderstandings, clarifies the science, and gives educators practical insight to serve all learners. Welcome to the Literacy in Color podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Sullivan, a science of reading advocate with over a decade of experience as a reading interventionist and literacy coach. I'm passionate about making evidence-based instruction both effective and engaging. If you're interested in captivating our learners on reading fluently and understanding language, or as I like to call it, keeping it colorful, then you've found the right place. Each week, we'll explore intriguing lit bits and practical strategies around the science of reading and structured literacy to help you be colorful and teach colorfully. Are you ready to bring literacy to life? Let's color outside the lines and make an impact together. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Literacy in Color. Today is a joy because I am joined with Dr. David Kilpatrick, and this past July, I had the honor of hearing him speak at the New York Reading League Summer Symposium organized by Lynn Carpenter, and he served as our keynote speaker. And after listening to him present, I was like, wow, everyone needs to hear this information. So thank you so much for joining me on the show today, Dr. Kilpatrick.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course. I know you need no introduction, but would you briefly share your background as it relates to this whole literacy realm?
Yeah, I've taught psychology. I'm in a psychology department at the State University of New York at Cortland. I've taught for 31 years. The courses I teach are on learning disabilities and then more broadly children with disabilities and educational psychology. So I got interested in reading because I worked previously as a school psychologist and the biggest referral was for reading. Our team got more referrals for reading than anything else. So that became an interest of mine. Now, what's important, I think, in terms of the background was that we were a whole word or whole language school, originally whole word when I showed up there in 1988. And then they switched over to whole language in the 90s. And the kids really got no phonics. So what ended up happening is the only time kids got phonics instruction was if they got designated as having a learning disability in reading and went off to the resource room. And our resource teacher was fantastic, and she had some great phonics programs and great success with that. But too many of the kids, they became good at sounding out words, but they didn't become good at remembering words. So as a result, that was an interest of mine. I had no idea how we remembered words. And I used to ask around, figuring all the educators must know, and turned out they didn't. And then by dumb luck, in the late 1990s, I came across Linnea Airey's explanation of how we remember words. And that's sort of been the framework through which I've interpreted hundreds of studies on word reading ever since.
Wonderful. And we had the pleasure of having Dr. Airy in the audience that day as well.
He has had to sit through me presenting on her theory. I think that was either the fourth time or the fifth time. I can't remember.
There you go. I love how Katie Pace Miles mentioned that you are president of the Linnea Airy fan club.
Absolutely.
So today, I want to talk about the instructional implications of phonemic awareness. I feel like in recent years, phonemic awareness has gotten quite a buzz. There's a lot of chatter around it and that there's a lot of confusion around it. And when we think about this vast body of research that we call the science of reading, what are some things that the research can tell us with confidence? And where does the research leave room for interpretation relying on teacher expertise?
Let me start with the first part of that. People often refer to the National Reading Panel, which is getting to be 25 years old now. Their findings still hold for sure. And what's interesting is there were similar reviews of research 10 years before that. And that's still as current today as it was then. And basically what the finding was, using only experimental studies, the reading panel came to the conclusion that teaching phonemic awareness, along with teaching letter sounds and reading instruction, results in better reading and spelling than not teaching phonemic awareness. Now, the problem is that among those experimental studies, they all did it in a variety of different ways. There's a whole bunch of different techniques that have been used to teach phonemic awareness. And what we don't really have is some sort of Consumer Reports comparison. I think when people hear about the research and the reading research, they think we have this stock of all these different studies where this particular technique is compared with that particular technique. We have a lot of research comparing whole approaches. So we have research comparing, say, the whole word approach versus the whole language approach versus a phonics approach. We have plenty of those. But each of those approaches contain a whole bunch of different specific instructional techniques. And we don't have nearly as much on the specific instructional techniques. And when we do, they're usually very short-term studies that last a couple of weeks and make a interesting comparison. And when we have such studies, yeah, it always makes good sense to go with the one that got the better results. But we don't know if those little, I call them lab studies, we don't know if those little lab studies really make a big difference in the long run. So just one quick example. Traditionally, you've had Orton Gillingham-inspired phonics programs, and you've had direct instruction programs like DISTAR or Reading Mastery. And they both are trying to teach the same skills to crack the code, but they're using very different techniques. And guess what? The results are pretty similar. So we don't really have available, here's a, like I said, a Consumer Reports comparison of all these particular techniques. And I think teachers assume that those are there. But I think instead we need to focus on what skills need to be learned and then allow teachers to use their professionalism and their knowledge to make sure those skills are taught.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a really important distinction for teachers to have in the back of their minds, because as a lot of the research is coming to light about the science of reading and structured literacy practices, many teachers
feel that everything I do now needs to be research-based, but there just may not be the research there. And when we think back, is this practice grounded in the research? That's maybe another lens to think about it, rather than, is there a study supporting this 5 minutes of my instructional time? There may not be, but we can look back on what's happening in the brain and if it's supporting the processes that are happening in the brain. So I know you mentioned the importance of having particular skills. Can you explain what the difference is between a task and a skill when it comes to phonemic awareness?
Yeah, we have to realize that the skills that we're talking about for reading, we can't see. They're between our ears. And so what we do is we use tasks, activities that we do with kids, either to assess or estimate that skill, or to train that skill, to teach that skill. Here's an example. In speech pathology test batteries, language batteries, they will sample some vocabulary words, say on a vocabulary test, and they'll start out with some easier words and get harder and harder and harder. Well, there's no way they're going to test every word that a child might be expected to know. They're just sampling. So that test is then used to infer, wow, kids that got a lot of items right, we assume have a broader vocabulary than kids that got fewer right. So we have to make a distinction between what we can't directly see, which is the skill, and a given task that we do with kids. And that's important when it comes to assessment and even possibly instruction, I think, because there's some of the skills that we try to get at, it's not always transparent is the best way to do that. And we find out the best way to do that by actually doing studies and looking at the correlational relationships. So for example, what's commonly recommended is to just teach kids to segment and blend, or just use segmentation and blending when you evaluate kids. Well, guess what? Those are two different tasks that seem some of the weaker correlations with reading than, say, a task like deletion or substitution. And deletion, it seems to me, that type of manipulation has been the primary approach for researchers to test phonemic awareness over the last 10, 15 or more years, because the correlations are so much stronger. So it's getting closer to mimicking the kind of skill that's underlying, or the relationship, its relationship with reading. And so researchers just don't use blending or segmenting nearly like they did back in the old days. In the old days, they just threw all kinds of tasks at kids. Now, related to this, some teachers hear about these different tasks and they say, well, let's see, should we do segmenting, blending? How about phoneme isolation? That's where you get kids to isolate where a sound is in a word. Or identification. I want the kids to each raise their hand every time I use a word with this sound in it. There are well over 20 different phonemic awareness tasks that have been used in the research literature. And I think what happens is teachers feel like they got to train all. Well, you're not training a task, you're training a skill. And so really, there are only two skills. There are only two phonemic skills that are needed for reading. The first is blending, because you need that when a child's sounding out a word, they have to blend it. The second is phoneme, I'm going to call it analysis, to be able to pull a word apart into its individual components. And that's needed for, it helps with spelling, but only to a limited degree. Once you get past simple CVC words, phonemic segmentation is limited. How is it going to help you distinguish between scent, scent, and scent, right? S-E-N-T, C-E-N-T, or S-C-E-N-T? It'll give you that first step to know you need letters in those positions, but it's not going to tell you what letters. And so it's a very limited help, segmentation, and therefore spelling, it doesn't account for why this is so important, but Aries theory does. So Aries theory indicates that we need to have access to the individual phonemes to anchor those letter strings in the memory. And as it turns out, we have to be able to do that very quickly and efficiently. So we need tasks that are more challenging than segmenting and blending. And this is probably why those tend to correlate more weakly with reading than some other tasks that researchers more commonly use.
I appreciate how you talked about the efficiency behind being able to utilize these skills, because oftentimes in the implementation, when we're doing segmenting or blending activities, the automaticity is not what's prioritized, but the automaticity is really what is fueling that orthographic mapping.
Well, that's right. Because again, if we're doing kind of this approach where we're throwing every type of phonemic activity at kids, just so we feel like we'll capture everything, we're not making the distinction between task and skill. If we understand what the skills are, again, kids have to learn to blend. How can you sound out a word if you can't blend? So that's essential for one of the two important aspects of word reading, and that is identifying a word. But then we also have to talk about remembering words. Now, those of us who are fortunate enough to have not had reading problems, and we have tens of thousands of words as adults stored away in our long-term memory, we did not put conscious effort into remembering those words. That process of those words going from being an unfamiliar word to a familiar word that jumps out at us instantly was an unconscious process behind the scenes. None of us have 50,000 flashcards stored in our basement in case we need to refer back to them, right? So if we are remembering words that fast, and Aries says that we have to access phonemes to remember words, that means we have to have automatic access to phonemes. And we do have research to show that, and here's what's interesting. If you have access to a university library and you do a search, you're not going to find this because we don't have keywords for this. But there have been numerous studies throughout the years. The earliest I find was 1989, where they show that individuals with dyslexia had slower access and slower responses to phonemic awareness tasks than individuals who were good readers. So they may get, some of the studies show that, especially with older children and adults, but even older elementary school kids, their number of correct items on segmentation and blending tasks were just as strong. And then we make the faulty inference that, oh, they have enough phonemic awareness for reading. No, it turns out that the speed of response differs. And the Wechsler Individual Achievement Test and the Phonemic Proficiency Subtest, we did a presentation at the Society for Scientific Study of Reading from that database, that nationally normed, nationally stratified database. And sure enough, the speed of response made a difference in terms of whether you were a skilled reader, a really strong reader, or not such a strong reader. If you got an item correct, but it was slow, like took longer than 2 seconds to respond, that did not correlate with reading. It was only the fast responses that correlated with reading. Now, traditionally, we've bundled those together. So what's been happening, this correlation of phonemic awareness and reading all these years has been carried by the speed of response element to it. So the idea is the two skills we need for reading are blending for sounding out words and access to phonemes, phoneme analysis for remembering words, but it has to be really fast. And too often we're just kind of blindly, okay, we'll train the blending, which it makes sense why blending is important. Most people can figure that out. But let's do these other segmentation type tasks. Why? Because the reading panel said it's important and research says it's important. I'm not really sure why, but we're just going to do it anyway. Okay, so we have to go past that. We have to understand what are the skills needed for reading and then work toward making sure those skills get developed.
Yeah. So we know that phonics is important in cracking the code, like you just said. And now you're talking about this need for phonemic proficiency as well. I think that's a term that might be unfamiliar to some educators. So can you quickly define the difference between this phonemic awareness and then phonemic proficiency and how that relates to orthographic mapping?
Sure. When I first started doing phonemic awareness tasks in the late 90s with kids, I was in a K-6 building. And I'm just going to focus on the older kids for a moment here. I'd get fourth, fifth, and sixth graders referred, and many of them would do okay on the phonemic tasks, but they were very slow. So for example, I'd say, you know, they'd start out with easy things, say baseball, but don't say base or whatever. And say cat without the cat. But then you'd get to like say sky and change the k to a little, and they would think and they would think and they would think. They'd come back 4, 5, 6 seconds later and they'd say sly. And you're like, good. I didn't know any better. I was just doing it the conventional way. I'd go back to the team and I'd say, nope, they can do phonemic awareness. They were able to do these, right? Well, then having a discussion with a third grade teacher in the building, and remember, no phonemic awareness was being done in that building at all. Very little phonics, if any. And so she had me screen her whole class, what eventually became the PASS test, the phonological awareness screening test. I was using my mentor's version, Phil McGinnis, who was using the Rosner and Simon 1971 test, which, by the way, is the equivalent to the elision subtest of the comprehensive test of phonological processing, CTOP. Anyway, very closely related. So I gave it to those kids, and these kids never had any phonemic awareness training at all. And the kids that were good readers, I'd say sky, sky. Now say it again instead of say a little sly. I'm like, whoa, these kids were responding instantly. They had only had 5 minutes of exposure to this type of task, and they were coming back instantly. Well, I thought to myself, I think I just discovered a new idea, only to find out it had been in the research literature, you know, years before, but I didn't know that yet. So anyway, phonemic awareness, think of the word awareness. Try to define awareness without using the word conscious. It's very difficult. So awareness assumes consciousness. But proficiency, when I use the word proficiency for letter sound proficiency or phonemic proficiency, I'm using it to refer to automaticity, done automatically without even thinking about it. So phonemic proficiency refers to instant automatic access to the phonemes without even thinking about it. And that has to be the case if what Ari's saying is true. Ari's saying that we are accessing the phonemes in the spoken word as we map and anchor that sequence of letters to long-term memory. So if we can have phonemic awareness and still be a poor reader. Actually, you can have phonemic proficiency and still be a poor reader. That's not the only element, right? You could be the best free throw shooter in the history of basketball and never make the team because you can't do the other parts of the game of basketball, right? But it's still a necessary component. So having phonemic awareness is not enough to propel your reading forward. You have to have a proficiency. And normally we don't distinguish those in a task. So kids might do well in phonemic awareness and do well in reading. Well, if you were to separate it out, you would find out that they're responding very quickly. And the only two tests I know are the Wechsler Individual Achievement Test, the phonemic proficiency subtest, which is part of a big battery and expensive. And the other is the one that's free. And that's what this phonemic proficiency subtest was based on, which is the phonological awareness screening test. And that allows you to separate out the instant responses from the slower responses.
That's so interesting. And when we think about students gaining this proficiency, oftentimes just simply the act of reading is going to help develop that proficiency for your typically developing reader, but that may not be the case for all of our students. Is that correct?
Yeah. This, I think, is the crux of a big problem we have, is people don't make a distinction between typically developing readers where all of this falls into place without any explicit instruction. You have plenty of kids taught during the whole word era, which I was, right? I started learning to read at age 6 in 1966, all right? And it was the whole word era, long before whole language kicked back in again. Whole language was popular in the late 1800s. It failed miserably, and it got brought back again and failed miserably again. We didn't learn from our mistake. But the whole word approach has been more dominant than the phonics approach throughout much of American history. So I learned through the whole word approach, and many other people learned through the whole word approach that were never explicitly taught phonics, and yet were good readers. Why? We figured out the phonics. We can sound out nonsense words. Phonics skills are not optional for skilled reading in an alphabetic writing system. Show me a child who is in third grade or older who has never taught phonics and is a good reader and can't sound out simple nonsense words. You're not going to find that kid. So the idea is that whether we're taught it or not, phonics is essential. Phonemic awareness is essential. Phonemic proficiency is essential. It just happens naturally for most kids. So what's happened is you have people out there that are saying things like, oh, you don't need this, you don't need that. It's just like saying, no, you don't need phonics. It's like, well, yeah, a lot of kids don't need it, but why wouldn't we teach it if everybody needs it? And why wouldn't we kind of do a little differentiation and not drum kids with phonics that don't need it, that are developing those skills just fine? Those are the kind of questions being asked. My whole career was about kids who struggle. So much of the chatter, now I'm not on social media in any way, but people do send me stuff. And so much of the chatter, I understand, they're not distinguishing between kids who have what has been traditionally called the phonological core deficit that leads to poor word reading and dyslexia, and kids where this all falls into place pretty nicely. And then there are kids in between. Most of us develop phonemic awareness simply by being taught an alphabetic writing system. And we've known for years that access to a letter alphabetic writing system helps develop those phonemic skills. And then people make the faulty inference from there that phonemic awareness is something we don't need to train or whatever. It's just going to happen anyway. Well, yeah, if you're blessed with sufficient phonological skills where that all falls into place. So my whole career has been about the kids in the bottom 5%, 10%, 20%, 25%. And we're leaving those kids behind when we make these claims that are only catering to the top 75%.
Yeah, absolutely. And that aligns beautifully with Nancy Young's ladder of reading that shows us the different types of learners that we have in our classroom. And for that bottom 5% or the bottom 15%, they're going to need that explicit instruction. And a lot of time in my experience has been spent in intervention as well. And so I too see the value in using these kinds of tasks with students and seeing the impact of that. But there is growing debate about oral-only phonemic awareness without letters. And the National Reading Panel stated phonemic awareness is better with letters than without, but never really defined what quote unquote with letters actually meant. So can you unpack that research for us a bit and tell us what it says or perhaps even what it doesn't say about oral only phonemic awareness?
Sure. So the reading panel, as I said earlier, they looked at all these experimental studies and they showed that teaching phonemic awareness resulted in better outcomes for reading and spelling and even to a lesser degree reading comprehension than when phonemic awareness was not taught. That was their experimental finding, period. Okay, the end of the story as far as that goes. But then what they did is they had all this research sitting in front of them that they reviewed to respond to that one simple question. And they thought, maybe we could be helpful because there are other factors that could be involved. And they called them moderator variables. Those looked at things like group size, the age of the kids. There were about 7 or 8 of them. And they began talking about those with this major caveat that my guess is, I mean, again, I'm not on social media, but I don't think people even talk about this caveat. They treat this issue of teaching phonemic awareness with letters versus without letters as if it was in the same category as their experimental finding of teaching phonemic awareness is superior to not teaching phonemic awareness. Well, in their caveat, they said these are correlational results only, not experimental. This is tentative. It's suggestive. It's not the final word. There could be some other third factor. They spent this intense paragraph bending over backwards to talk about how tentative this was. Anyway, one of those 8 moderating variables was teaching phonemic awareness with letters versus without letters. Now, they never actually defined what they meant by with letters and without letters. Well, I've read every single one of the 52-53 reports. There were 96 comparisons in those reports. I've read every single one of those twice. I'm going through a third time for another project. And it's very clear when you do that exactly what they meant by that term. They didn't define it. But if you take the time to look at the full report and you take the time to look in Appendix F, which tells you which studies they considered to be teaching phonemic awareness with letters and which studies were teaching phonemic awareness without letters. In their description, this is the full report, not the little summary that circulates. In the full report, I'm telling you, you don't have to read all 52 reports to come to this conclusion I'm about to say. You look at Appendix F, they described 8 different phonemic awareness studies, every one of which was in the with letters category. Every single one of the ones they described taught phonemic awareness using oral activities, but only included letters at some later point in the instruction. And that varied a little bit from one study to the next. Every one of them did oral activities. Now, what's also interesting is several of them continued doing oral activities even after letters were introduced. And not one of them said anything about discontinuing doing oral phonemic awareness activities after letters introduced. Those are all part of popular National Reading Panel social media mythology. You know, I got to tell your listeners something important. You know, this is the kind of thing their parents should sit down and tell them. But not everything you hear on social media is accurate. Okay, hate to be the one to break that to you. I know that's a big shock, okay? What's really scary, however, is some folks with academic positions, people that have letters after their name, that teach at a university, they are passing along a bit of misinformation that started, the best I can track it, is a blogger that was not a teacher, not an educator, not a researcher, who just didn't seem to like the concept, loved phonics, but didn't seem to like the concept of phonemic awareness. And he seemed to have his idea that with letters meant that letters should be visibly in front of the children when you teach phonemic awareness, and that sort of caught on. And then some people in academia, when this stuff was so popular, simply were repeating what was out on social media. My question is, can you show me one study where they did an experimental comparison where letters were in front of the kids during phonemic awareness instruction versus oral activities? Show me one study, just one study. And when people appeal to the National Reading Panel, they don't realize they have no foundation for that view. Now, what's interesting is the without letter studies, if you look at those, they're very clear. They never tied the phonemic awareness instruction back to their ELA program in any way, shape, or form, not with letters, not with words, nothing. So what they were reviewing were studies where oral activities were conducted with no reference back to reading or letters or spelling or anything, compared to studies where 80% of which taught phonemic awareness using oral activities and then introduced letters at some point. The other 20% of the studies did use letters from the beginning, but interestingly, they really focused on the phonemes. So they would have kids come up with, generate the phonemes, and then present letters after that. So the problem is that the way people are talking about it now, there's really no longer a distinction between phonics and phonemic awareness. It's undermining the whole point the reading panel sought to establish in the first place. And the kids who need it the most are not going to get it. What you're going to do is you're going to get like those kids that resource teacher had that were good at sounding out words, but they're not good at remembering words because their phonemic awareness is not going to be trained beyond just their simple letter sound knowledge.
That's so important. And we all see these bits and pieces on social media or on different online platforms. And quite frankly, teachers don't have time to dig into these research reports and to know what they actually have to say. So to hear your expertise and knowledge and having done the heavy lifting and sifting through, I think is really valuable for all educators to hear and to know what it really was meant by with letters. And it's like this integration piece. Of course, eventually we're going to bring it in, but there was still this oral component, and that oral component still held value. And you know, with my parent hat on, my older daughter, she's 5.5 years old now. She's entering kindergarten. I had the pleasure of teaching her how to read because I knew she was developmentally ready for that. And how did I know? Is because we were doing oral-only phonemic awareness activities together. We would do that in the car. And I would say, guess my secret word, k-at. And every so often, she would say car, banana. She would make up these words. She didn't understand the concept. And once she was able to actually blend those sounds, that's when I brought in the letters. I said, oh, she's ready to read. She understands this concept of blending. She has this underlying skill of blending. So now let's apply letters and bring it into print. You alluded to this already, but just for further clarification, when is this oral-only phonemic awareness appropriate and with which students? And are there risks in involving letters too soon or too late with certain groups?
Well, my angle is, and some people have misrepresented what I've ever said, that somehow you have to have a certain amount of phonemic awareness or phonological awareness before you introduce letters. I've never said that, never even thought it. It doesn't make any sense to me. But people feel like they can make up stuff and whatever. It's unfortunate. So to me, I think letters can start as soon as early as you want. You want to show kids letters and teach them, you know, with letters in the refrigerator or some other type of thing or some app when they're 2 or 3 or 4. Fine. It's great, right? For typically developing readers, it is by way of letters that we learn phonemic awareness. There's only 3 words in English that are a single phoneme. You have like a book, right? You have I, first person singular. And then you have like, oh, look at that. That's it. We don't have other, I mean, we have other word-like things like, that tastes good, right? We have a little of those, but they're not words. You know, I've looked them all up in the dictionary. Don't worry, I've tried. You can do it yourself if you want. So there's really only 3 single phoneme words. When we learn letter sounds, for the first time, we're hearing t, m, z, r, a. And so what happens in typically developing readers? Phoneme awareness develops. And we do letters and sounds and letters and sounds throughout kindergarten and first grade. It becomes automatized and you develop the phonemic proficiency. And then you're good at orthographic mapping. Everything falls into place. But children with the phonological core deficit, the kids in the bottom 5, 10, 15, 20%, those kids do not develop the phonemic awareness they need for reading simply by learning letter sounds. And that's where the problem comes in. Just because kids endowed with more well-developed phonemic skills pick this up on their own, That doesn't mean other kids don't. So they need very direct instruction. Now, we only have about an 80% accuracy rate in screening for later reading problems. So the different screenings that we can do in kindergarten, we're about 80% accuracy of predicting how they're going to do at the end of first grade or second grade in reading. 80% is not enough. You know, you're talking, you know, millions of kids that we would miss in any given year. So really, the suggestion made by the panel and others is that we should do explicit phonemic awareness, and that includes oral activities. Once you introduce letters, now you're into your letter sound work. That doesn't mean you can't integrate them. Like some of the studies in the with letters category are doing what along the lines of what some people would call linguistic phonics, where it's like, okay, what's the first sound you hear in make? Good. All right, well, here's the letter M, right? So they have now generated it through oral phoneme activity. Then the letter gets immediately introduced. Okay, that's all great stuff. Now, that may not be enough for some kids on the lower end. But the idea is that you have to develop the skills. You can't know if a child has phonemic awareness when they have letters in front of them, because they have a cheat sheet. They have the answers right there. If you have the word cat in front of a child and you say, what's the sound you hear at the end of cat? They just have to look at the T and say, T, because they have the letter sound knowledge for T. So when it comes to assessment, it's got to be oral only. All right. I don't think you're going to find too much disagreement among researchers on that regard. But how much and for, you know, which kids, that is always going to be a decision by educators that are knowledgeable of this. But I'd say through kindergarten and first grade, you want to accompany oral activities. And what always is kind of sad and amusing at the same time is when people say, we don't want to waste time on, well, I know there is a program out there that you got to spend 20 minutes on, blah, blah, blah. But most phonemic awareness activities, you're talking about a couple minutes here, a couple minutes there. You're investing 5, 8, 10 minutes a day at the most spread throughout the day. And it can be integrated into the letter sound work as well. So I'd say K1, you know, you have kids like the PASS. It's a free test, phonological awareness screening test. It's also going to get at the speed of response. You have kids that ace the PASS automatically at the end of first grade. They don't need any more phonemic awareness. So I think we have to make that distinction and differentiate the kids, because other kids, if we use the top 75% as our point of reference, we're going to leave kids behind.
Yeah. And even recent research, I feel like you have to look at what bank of students were involved in the study. And it's hard to generalize research for everyone. You have to look at who was involved, what were the variables, what were the subset of tasks at hand, and if you can make this generalization for all, or was it just in this particular scenario? So I think that's an important thing to keep into consideration as well. And another thing that I really appreciated, I read a blog post by Tim Shanahan on phonemic awareness and evolved some of yours and Dr. Aries' thinking. And she had written even in the comments to someone, and I have it in front of me, so I'll read it. But she said, when students spell words, breaking apart pronunciations into phonemes automatically activates graphemes representing those phonemes. So this whole concept of with the letters, and in the beginning, you talked about what's happening between our ears, we're automatically bringing about that letter in our conscious brain that it doesn't always even have to be in front of the student. But when you have that strong connection between the phonemes and the graphemes, when you hear the sound, your brain's automatically associating that letter. And I could think back even with particular students doing phonemic awareness tasks, when you say the word smile, what's the first sound you hear in smile? And they'll say S. And you're like, oh, wait, no, I asked for the sound. And that's because they have that association of the grapheme-phoneme relationship, I think.
That's correct. And we have had research for decades, including some early studies she did in the 80s, to show that we do have that instant activation and it increases and becomes stronger throughout life. But the problem is that is not necessarily the case for some of these lower, weaker readers. Okay. And for one thing, and secondly, there's lots of slippage. I gave you the example of scent, scent, and scent. Okay. So are you going to activate the C for scent, or are you going to activate the SC, or are you going to activate the S? Which is it going to be? Let me try this little simple phonemic awareness activity with you. Okay. Just one item. Ready? Say the word nine.
Nine.
Now say nine instead of I, say oh.
Known.
How come you didn't say none?
Yeah.
Okay. So what's happening is you had to activate phonemes. You had to activate the phonology. Had you simply activated the letter, your response would have been none. This item isn't on the PASS test anymore, but it was for a long time with hundreds of kids. Say love. Now say love, but don't say lol. Nobody ever said ov. They always said of. And so on the PASS test, phonological awareness screening test, and the phonemic proficiency subtest, all of the responses are orthographically inconsistent with the prompt. And the purpose there is to minimize the use of mental spelling. It doesn't automatically. Now, in the case of 9 to known, that not only minimized it, it prevented it, right? There was no way you could have gone from 9 to known without going the phonology route and just going the orthography route and the spelling route, right? So, yeah, so that's why, like in the past, the tests we have those and the phonemic proficiency subtest. I help them. The folks at Pearson design the reading subtest, the word reading subtest, and the phonemic subtest for the Wechsler Individual Achievement Test. I insisted on not getting paid, and I did not get paid. I have no financial involvement in it. But basically, it is a norm version of the past. And so the very strong results that came from that add to the validity of the PASS test, which again is free, thepasstest.com. It's free online. You got to read it. You got to practice it. Don't just do it. Don't wing it. You want to know that you're getting valid results. So yes, what she's saying is true, but we have to be very, so many things in this area are nuanced. We have to look carefully at how we're applying it. Yeah, we've known for decades the automatic letter activation when we hear sounds, but there's just too much slippage to take that information too far.
Yeah, English is so layered. So for educators swinging in the direction of believing that oral-only phonemic awareness is never appropriate, what would you say to that kind of comment?
Show me one study.
Yeah.
Show me one study. They don't exist, okay? As far as I know, and I've read hundreds of studies in the area of phonemic skills, that opinion is based upon a viral idea put forth by some blogger that wasn't familiar with this research, and it just caught on. And so it's a misrepresentation of what the panel said. They have no basis for that comment.
Thank you for that. I think that's something that needs to be heard by all educators, because I feel like truly most educators, if you're in this craft, you want to do right by kids. And now teachers want to do what the research says. And if they think that's what the research says, these ideas become mainstream. So I think it's important that we hear this type of messaging. And in my experience as well, I've had so many interactions with students where they see a word in print and they say the sounds and then they blend a completely different word. And sometimes the strategy then is, oh, well, use continuous blending if they're not saying the word appropriately. So for example, if the sounds are m-at, then try mat and see if they can do it that way. But I've had so many experiences where students will still say the completely wrong word, like banana, or maybe even tam. And so then sometimes we pull a phoneme back, go back to two phoneme words. And sometimes that's still too much. And so what we've always done is then you take the letters away and try to do it with the phonemes. And there's this idea that sometimes the letters can be cognitive overload for our students before they have solid phonemic awareness. So does this align with the research or what you've even seen in your practice?
Well, there are some of what I referred to earlier as lab studies to show that the continuous blending seems to work better than a more discrete, separate blending. And I would say that's probably the way to go, right? Here's what we don't have, and I know I'm cycling back a little bit. The only way we could know a very specific technique is superior and research-based would be if you had, let's say you had two groups of first graders getting the exact same overall instruction in reading with all the same techniques, but one. Just one very specific technique differed between the groups, but everything else was the same. And at the end of the year, one group outdid the other, then you could say that is supported. But when you do something where you have kids come in and you do a lesson for one or two times, and then you come back a week later and find out which of the two approaches they remember more words from, that's too short term. That's too lab. We just don't know. Again, when you hear those studies, go with the one that did better, right? And they would, of course, that would make sense. We just don't really know. So I think the idea is teachers get a better understanding of the skills that need to be developed. They can, as I try to say, have to become educational MacGyvers, like the MacGyver TV show. He was so knowledgeable that he was able to apply that knowledge in any given circumstance and whatever happened to come up. And the more teachers know, the more they would be able to do that. MacGyver, by the way, is in the dictionary now. It's okay to use that term. So here's an example I gave. I don't know if I gave it at the presentation you saw, but I coached basketball for many years, third grade to eighth grade, as my kids went through the community league. And having five kids, that means I end up coaching for over 10 years. And one night, the seventh and eighth graders were shooting right directly line drive at the basket. And I tried to explain to them, look, put an arc on the ball, put a big arc on it. So if the ball's coming down from above, you have this huge target. But when it's coming line drive, it has a very narrow target. And they didn't pay any attention to me. So what I did when they were practicing their free throws is I went and I grabbed a folding chair off to the side, folded it up, held the legs, held the chair way up over my head, and forced them to put an arc on the ball. And the balls were dropping left and right. And the kids, it was one of our favorite practices. The kids were so excited how many more shots they were making. And so let me ask you this. Did I read a random control trial on that? No. No, I knew what skill needed to be developed. And I took the steps to see to it that that skill got developed. And that's kind of an analogy of what teachers need to do. And so we need to develop what we know are the skills that are central to reading. And that varies based on approach. So the old whole word approach, it was the skill in visual memorization. And whole language was the skill of guessing from context. As it turns out, those are not skills important for reading at all. But we now do know what skills are important, and we need to take the steps to see to it that the kids develop those skills.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that analogy. And in the beginning, you had talked about the importance of deletion and substitution in some of those studies. And I know you referred at the symposium, you said they're not just mental gymnastics when we're doing those types of things. So can you just clarify the purpose of those, like addition and deletion?
Yeah. And again, this gets back to the skill versus task. I think one of the things very heavily in my field of the school psychology field is good old fashioned Skinner behaviorism. Let's only go with what we can see. Let's not talk about what's going on behind our ears. Very unscientific, right? You know, we haven't seen a proton, a neutron, or electron, but we measure them all the time. So we also have to be able to measure aspects of our memory. And that's what's gone on throughout the rest of the sciences. Anyway, we have to break through and recognize we want to assess what's going on cognitively. And we need to be able to know, does the child have instant access to the letter sounds, for one, and secondly, to the phonemes within the word? That's so critical for remembering words. So with that said, a segmentation task, interestingly, in Oliveri's writing, she talks about segmentation, but she's talking about the mental skill. She's not talking about a task. And so that's the reason why I keep saying phoneme proficiency, when what I really mean is, all right, I'm going to say this quietly, I hope nobody's listening, but phoneme segmentation proficiency, because that's the part that's important. But when people hear segmentation, they think of the task. And as it turns out, segmentation tasks will correlate with reading, for any of you that are familiar with how correlations work, somewhere in the range of 0.3, 0.4, maybe hit 0.5 in first grade, possibly even second grade, and then drop down dramatically after that. Well, as it turns out, just a segmentation task is too easy. And so even children with reading problems can go on by the end of second grade and segment words. Most typically developing kids can segment any English word at the end of first grade. But then the kids with reading problems, they can do it by the end of second grade, but they don't have to do it quickly. And it's hard to know if they're doing it quickly. If you say to a child, tell me all the sounds in sky, and they go, sky, you don't know if they have instant access to those phonemes. They could have just tracked through the word. Just like if you had asked them, I want you to count to five as fast as you can, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Did they have instant access to all those unconsciously, or did they track through 1 through 5, right? But if you say to a child, say sky, and change the k to a l, and they come back at you fast. Now, I've been timing that. Other researchers have timed it. Kids are coming in at about 0.7 of a second or 0.5 a second with a task like that. That means they did 4 mental operations in under a second. First, they segmented, and that's the important part. But also, they did phoneme isolation, figured out where it was in the word, beginning, middle, or end. Then they did the substitution. Then they have a different sequence of sounds they had to blend. So doing 4 mental operations in 0.7 of a second tells me that that first one, the only one we're concerned about, which is the mental segmentation, is automatic. I can't tell that for sure from a segmentation task. So whether it is assessing that skill or even training that skill to know that a child is doing it quickly, there's definitely some merit in that. And as I said, most researchers use most commonly deletion, but also occasionally substitution or spoonerisms or other manipulation type tasks when they test phonemic awareness, because the correlations with segmentation and blending are much lower and they drop off after first grade. What's exciting about all this in relation to Arie's theory, which her theory would have predicted this, on the Wechsler Individual Achievement Test, the correlations between those phonemic tasks do not drop throughout the entire lifespan. Show me anything as strong as that, that nationally normed, nationally stratified sample. The correlation with reading is 0.6 or higher throughout the entire lifespan. Age 14 and 15 drop down to 0.5, which you barely ever get in first grade with segmentation, by the way. And then it jumps back up for adulthood to over 0.6. So that's telling us something about the phonemic processes needing for reading. And so that's important for us to do that and not just go with a lesser. An analogy I give is I had a shoulder injury. They took an x-ray and they didn't see anything. And they basically are saying, Dave, your hypochondria is flaring up again. Okay. And so I did PT, I did everything. And then finally I did an MRI. And the MRI said, oh, you have torn cartilage. That doesn't show up in the x-ray. Okay. Torn labrum was what it was. So your simple phonemic awareness task, segmentation, blending, doing that and screening, is that going to, yes, but that's going to catch probably the most serious cases, but you're going to have a lot of other more subtle cases slip through. And so doing some sort of phoneme manipulation task, as researchers most commonly do, is going to allow us a better idea of where the child's phonemic skills are.
That's so interesting. And this is another idea that is running rampant in the social media world about how blending and segmenting are your powerhouse skills, but really they're tasks, right? And there's no research to support some of these advanced skills. But I know there's programs like LIPS from Linda Moodbell. They do this with some older learners, and their research is really strong to support that.
Here's what's interesting. There's over 1,000 scientific studies related to reading published every single year. And when people say there's no research to support, I'm like, really? You're reading 1,000 articles a year? You know, unfortunately, as you know, people out on social media, they tend to pontificate. Everybody's an expert. There's many reasons I'm not out on social media. And I think that's one of them, because I just think it's a problem. But what I try to do is stick with what I know there is research support for. And everything I've said today, other than maybe the anecdotal examples of the basketball or whatever, everything I've said today, within a few mouse clicks on my computer, I could show you the studies behind it. Okay. So I make it a point to not speculate beyond, or else I will be extremely clear that I'm speculating. The reading panel tried to do that. Where do you hear out in social media that when the with letters thing was talked about was just a tentative thing by the research, by the National Reading Panel? Where do you hear that? Do you hear that? I don't know. I mean, maybe that's being said, but I've not cycled back. A lot of people send me stuff because I'm like, oh my gosh, can you believe they're saying this, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I do have a little bit of a sense of what's going on. But unfortunately, and what's really concerning for me is when people in academic positions simply forward the information that they've also gotten off social media.
Yeah. Could be dangerous, especially when we think about pendulum swings and people talk about things not working. Well, we need to be careful and be wise consumers of everything that we read when we consider the implementation of evidence-based practices and such. And you mentioned before your experiences with striving learners. And when we think about some of these tasks or skills, how can we ensure that advanced phonemic awareness isn't implemented as this blanket whole class approach, but rather as this targeted intervention?
Yeah, you bring up the term advanced phonemic awareness. There's an interesting history on that. So social media kind of got that all messed up. Tim Shanahan and I worked a lot on one of his blogs together, and the whole concept backfired because they didn't even read his blog. So if you look at some of the comments below, it's like, did you actually read what it said up there? He was great. He and I must have talked for 2 hours before this. I suggested the title, something like Rest in Peace, Advanced Phonemic Awareness, because the rest in peace was, it's that term. It was the term that needs to rest in peace. And then, so anyway, in a book that I wrote where I introduced, remember I told you that phonemic proficiency was already in the research literature, but it didn't have a name. Do you know, Linnea Arie talked about her sight word learning for decades before she ever gave it a name in 2014, orthographic mapping. Well, in the same way, this phonemic proficiency had no name. They just described what they did, you know, speed of response, whatever. So I wrote a book that came out in 2015, and I felt like I needed to give the concept a name because it was so important for understanding how Aries theory works, et cetera. And so I decided, for variety's sake, to use two different terms. One was phonemic proficiency. The other was advanced phonemic awareness. Every single incident where I referred to advanced phonemic awareness, I was referring to a mental skill we can't see, not to a task. Well, out on social media, the term advanced phonemic awareness started getting used for certain types of tasks. So once that started happening, that's when I thought it's time to abandon the term. It's not you being used. It's being misrepresented of what my point was. And I just used the term phonemic proficiency, or I'll say more descriptively, instant access to phonemes or whatever. So Tim loved the term because it's just very provocative. You know how he is, right? But that was a term I suggested. Rest in peace, advanced phonemic. Let's get rid of that term because it does one thing, confuse. Nothing more than that. Okay, it just doesn't serve any purpose. But then he kind of covered that in the context of the blog, and people, now what people interpret, they don't read stuff. This is a problem. You ask any college professor, students aren't reading things anymore. Well, guess what? Some college professors aren't reading stuff before they post online. I mean, I'll give you an example. There is no controversy about with letters or without letters in the research literature. That is only in the popular social media, all right? So sure enough, some researchers, and it came out in a very reputable journal last year, some researchers wanted to create the impression it was also a question in the research. They only could come up with two sources of people that were advocating for teaching phonemic awareness only without tying it in with letters. And one cited a book I wrote. I never even thought that. It never says that in there anyway, et cetera, even though that's out on social media. So I contacted one of the authors, one of the lead authors, and I said, where'd you get that from? Where does it say? Please tell me where in anything I've ever written would ever suggest that. And the response was, oh, well, that's what I thought you said. I'm like, wait, you're citing something as if it's a sort. They tried to create the impression. How it made it past the reviewers, I don't know. They tried to create the impression that this with letters or without letters is an issue in the research literature, which it is not. The other source, the same thing. The other source, at least there were a couple, you could pull out a quote out of context to create that impression. But in another place in that same thing, they were so clear to the contrary. So here you have people that aren't reading things and citing them. And that's happening. And that's really unfortunate. So if you read the reading panel, if you cross-reference Appendix F, which tells you which are the with letters and without letters, what's the reading panel says is crystal clear, but people aren't doing that. I don't know if they're just passing along what they've heard or if they are only reading the summary or whatever, but that's a problem. And I realize that teachers can't be rummaging through all that. So I guess my appeal is to my colleagues that have university positions is I think there's an assumption, an unwritten assumption, that if you say something publicly, you've done your due diligence to look into it. And aren't just forwarding what you heard. The only thing I forward what I heard in my classes are in some of my courses, I'll repeat stuff I've heard from larger textbooks, not that I've actually read the articles, but you can't do that. These fields are so huge. Nobody can teach any course where they have traced back every single article unless they wrote the textbook themselves, right?
Yeah. Just to clarify that term, advanced phonemic awareness, again, it really muddies the waters because it's describing tasks as if they were a skill. And when we hear advanced, most people are assuming you're talking about those manipulation tasks like addition or deletion or substitution. And while those might vary in complexity, they don't necessarily represent this advanced skill. The actual skill that we're looking for is that phoneme proficiency, that automatic access to the phonemes. That's correct?
Yeah. What we're interested in is determining the skill that's needed to help kids read. And given the fact that the process of remembering words goes on pretty much unconsciously behind the scenes, that means the skills needed, which is access to phonemes and access to letter sounds, also have to be automatic. And the traditional blending and segmentation tasks don't let us know that. So you don't have to have automaticity with those to track through a word with a segmentation task. But if you do a phoneme substitution task, for example, or even deletion task, if you say sky without the k, you get sigh, right? So If you do that instantaneously, that means that you had to segment, you had to do what's called phoneme isolation. You had to figure out where that was in the word and delete it. And then you had a different sequence. So to now blend. So you did multiple things in a short amount of time. And some researchers, and we've also done this, show that kids can do this in like literally half a second. And so those multiple operations are going on in half a second. And that tells us the very first step, being able to segment and pull that apart into individual phonemes, has got to be automatic. So that's why researchers for quite a while now have mostly relied on those more complex tasks and nowadays seem to rarely use blending and segmenting.
And so for people who are in the camp of being used to using that terminology of advanced when it comes to those manipulation tasks, is there a different terminology maybe we should be using rather than advanced? Or should we just umbrella term, they're just tasks?
I think when it comes to, if we distinguish between tasks and skills, originally in the 2015 book I wrote where I introduced that term, I was referring to a skill. But that's all got ruined. Or I don't know if I say ruined, just reused, repurposed, whatever you want to say. The point is, it no longer has that nuance. So I think it's best to abandon it. But the term that was parallel with that all the way along, which is a skill, and that is phonemic proficiency or phonemic automaticity. So automatic access to phonemes is needed for this automatic memory process to anchor the string of letters in a word to the string of phonemes in the spoken word. That's what Aries theory is saying. My recommendation would be to just not use it anymore. And if you're talking about phoneme deletion, you can call it phoneme deletion. If you want to talk about phoneme substitution, or often those get grouped together and they're called phoneme manipulation. But, you know, we have this terminology problem in the reading research field, and some have referred to, including the reading panel, have referred to the term manipulation to cover every single phonemic task. But more often than not, manipulation is going to refer to deletion and substitution, but occasionally some of the other tasks like transposition or reversal or spoonerisms or Pig Latin.
Okay. I know it's always tricky. We have to define our terms from the get-go, because if one person uses one term and another person has a different understanding, that's where the confusion lies. So I appreciate these little things to iron it out.
And I would also say that word advanced is not appropriate for phoneme manipulation, because some very simple basic skill of, say, cat without the app, that's not very advanced, but it does involve manipulation. So that's what happens when you take a term that was intended for one thing, apply it to something else. To equate advanced phonemic awareness with manipulation tasks is problematic for the reason I just gave. You can have very simple, non-advanced types of tasks that you can do with kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when we think about implementation, how can we ensure that these phonemic awareness tasks involving manipulation might not be used as this blanket whole class activity, but really targeted as maybe an intervention or for students who might need it the most?
The reality is a large percentage of kids, they just don't need this type of training in the first place. In fact, most adults who are good readers never were taught in phonemic awareness. But what we now know is, as we understand the phonemic properties of learning to read and why that's holding kids back, we have about an 80% accuracy rate of taking data in kindergarten and predicting how well you're going to be reading at the end of first or second grade. Now, maybe that sounds impressive. It shouldn't, because when you take the 20% where we're wrong and multiply that across the country, you're talking a huge, you know, hundreds of thousands of kids, literally, that we're going to get wrong. And so the recommendation the reading panel had and others have had is you do that kind of stuff for everybody in kindergarten and probably throughout most of first grade. But, you know, you have the PASS test, for example, the phonological awareness screening test. If by mid to late first grade, the kids are acing that and getting instantaneous responses, et cetera, they're done. They're fine. And so, unfortunately, the impression I've gotten on social media is I'm getting blamed for people who apply these things to all these kids that don't need it later on. And it's like, where did that come from? You know, I've never recommended that. So the idea is they need as much phonemic awareness training as is required for them to become good at it. And for some kids, right out of the starting gates, they're going to be fine with it. So I think what happens is you can do whole class K1, like was recommended by the reading panel, And in some cases, you might want to do whole class second and third and fourth, depending on the level. If you have a large portion of kids that are doing very poorly in reading, as is the case in some schools, you may want to consider doing whole class stuff as well. And the kids that are good at it, they love doing those things anyway, right? And they don't take a whole lot of time, at least shouldn't anyway. So I think teachers need to use their own good sense and professionalism to say which kids really need this and which kids don't. And I think that's really what needs to be considered.
Yeah. And it's like bottom line, we have to be responsive and let the data and let the students in front of us guide our instructional choices.
And I would say to add to that on the other end is there's no stopping point for kids who aren't getting it. So what's happened is that because the correlation between blending and segmenting drops off after first grade, people have made the faulty inference that therefore phonemic awareness is important after first grade. But if you look at the data from the Wechsler Individual Achievement Test, which is a nationally normed test, and their phonemic proficiency subtest, you see that instant access to phonemes correlates with reading 0.6 or higher right up through adulthood. And so the idea is if you have a child in second, third, fifth, ninth, 12th, that is struggling with phonemic awareness, there's no point where you say, well, let's just abandon that and go on to other things. No, we don't have good reason based on our understanding of how reading works and how we remember words. We have no reason to think that kids are going to start to take off in reading if they can't do one of the central underlying skills that are needed for reading. It's almost like saying, look, there comes a point where, hey, that flat tire, you know, we've had that flat tire a long time. Let's just keep driving on it, right? So there is no end point where we say no longer do we need phonemic awareness for a kid who doesn't get it. So on the one hand, we don't want to be drilling kids with stuff they don't need. On the other hand, we don't want to leave kids and abandon kids who need a skill that's very trainable.
Yeah. And the bottom line is for some students, this is essential and we don't want to stop doing it if that's exactly what they need in order to move on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm also curious, for the proficient adult who obviously is literate, can read and write, but has difficulty with some of the complex tasks, what would you say about that scenario?
Well, one of the things we always have to keep in mind as we're talking about the distinction between skill and task is how much of it is the task possibly getting in the way. So that was one of the reasons on the PASS, the phonological awareness screening test, we decided to give corrective feedback for every incorrect item to be sure that they understood the task. And with a lot of adults, very often what happens is we start with some of these harder items instead of giving them the lead up with, you know, say baseball, but don't say base. Okay, say cat without the k. And so if you suddenly hit an adult with a complex task out of nowhere, many of them fumble through because the task is unusual. But when you get that little run up, adults generally do pretty well that are good readers. But ultimately, it's the skill. One interesting thing is some study that was done by some British researchers back in the 90s, Hume, Snowling, and a couple other of their colleagues. They work with kids with mild intellectual disabilities, and they were good readers because they had presumably had all the underlying skills. Now, granted, their reading comprehension was weak because of the intelligence issue, but they did some standard phonemic tasks with them, and the kids didn't do well. And they were puzzled because these researchers have been for 30 years at the cutting edge or more understanding phonology and reading. And then what they did, it would take me 5 minutes to set this up, so I can't, but they came up with a different angle or a different task to get at it, and these kids did beautifully. So it turned out the task was getting in the way of reflecting their skill, and they came up with another task that was able to reflect that skill. So it's quite possible an adult could get a little confused on one of these, but if they are good readers and they're good at remembering words after only seeing it once or twice, they probably have the skill.
That's really helpful to know, and all goes back to that task versus skill mentality. We have to make sure we understand those are two completely different things. So I think that's a wonderful sentiment to wrap up our conversation. But I would love to have your final thoughts on just a few things, even if it's just a sentence or two, just to clear up the air. What do you think has been one of the most misunderstood or misinterpreted things about your work in recent years?
I think I just said them, that somehow I'm advocating or not tying it in with letters, even though I always have, in the misuse of the term advanced phonemic awareness. The only time I bring it up is to tell people I don't use the term anymore and it shouldn't be used. Yeah.
Yeah. And that phonemic proficiency goes back to that brain processing and the automaticity in accessing those phonemes.
Mm-hmm.
So what's one myth about phonemic awareness that you wish would disappear?
Well, yeah, I think we've been talking about the whole time that somehow letters should be visible to kids when they do that. Just to kind of summarize what I said, number one, the reading panel never downplayed oral phonemic awareness. They never did that. And they couldn't, had no research to do for such a basis, right? That's a total misinterpretation of the term with letters. Secondly, they never said that letters need to be visible for students. And third, they never said to discontinue phonemic awareness after letters are introduced. One of the things that concerns me that they brought up, and then another meta-analysis recently brought up, was how much phonemic awareness do you need to teach? And that was non-experimental. And if we do not have a study where they had two groups and one got X amount of time and the other got X plus whatever, we have no such study like that. And so what they were doing is they're comparing apples to oranges, to lemons, to pears. And if you take their logic seriously, and they talk about this upside down U shape or whatever, you get the impression that if you continue to teach phonemic awareness, they're going to get worse and worse at phonemic awareness and reading. No, no study shows that. Okay.
And then we'll end on an inspiring note, but what's one piece of advice that you'd give to educators who are supporting students with severe phonological deficits?
Just become aware of what your target is, what are the skills the kids need, and use your professional abilities to grab that folding chair and make sure the kids put the arc on the ball. Make sure that they develop the key skills, the letter sound skills, the automatic phonemic skills that they need to be good word readers. And of course, set for variability, practice that, and get kids doing read, read, read. Yeah.
I appreciate that. So Dr. Kilpatrick, this has been such a pleasure. I appreciate all of your work in the field and what you do to advance literacy for all of us, and just your wisdom in sharing that all with us today. And I hope this message rings really clearly for those listening about the importance of phonemic awareness. And I truly appreciate your time. We certainly will link the PASS test and Equip for Reading Success in your books in the show notes. Thank you again so much for your time. It's really appreciated.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning into Literacy in Color. I hope today's episode left you feeling both inspired and equipped with something new to add to your teaching toolkit. If you're enjoying this podcast, it would truly mean so much to me if you'd leave a 5-star review. It helps other educators find the show and join our colorful community. And don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button so you never miss an episode. For more tips, tools, and resources, be sure to check out the links in the show notes at michelleandthecolorfulclassroom.com. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next week. Until then, be colorful and teach colorfully.